Hey, what is going on, Los Angeles? It's J.Dot T.Dot, and I hope that you're so well. On this installment of JT the LA Storyteller podcast, yours truly sits down with former LA City Council member Mike Bonin, who was also just named a Leadership in Government Fellow by the Open Society Foundation. Mike and I talk about a range of issues in Los Angeles as of late, including an impending eviction on the west side of Los Angeles at the Barrington Plaza. We also talk about affordable housing, including impediments to affordable housing, such as these 30 to 50 year covenants. And we talk about what the city attorney's office, that is Heidi Feldman Soto's office, can and should be doing for tenants all across the city. It is both a privilege and an honor to hop on with Mike, and I do hope to have him back on the show again very soon. And if you enjoy this podcast episode, please be sure to hit that follow button, as well as to support where you can. Right now, I'm fundraising for the 9th anniversary of Jimbo Times. That's right, by seeking out $900 for the occasion. If you want to make a one-time contribution, you can find the link to do so in the show notes. And if you would like to be a monthly supporter or subscriber, you can do so via Patreon, which is also in the show notes. Okay, that does it for me. Until the next time, stay vigilant and stay tuned. It's J.Dot T.Dot, out with more soon. It's Jimbo Times. First of all, I want to welcome you, Mike Bonin, to JT the LA Storyteller podcast in the brand new studio setup. Mike, how are you doing?
I am doing great. Never been better, actually. Enjoying semi-retirement and different ways of causing trouble.
Oh, you are definitely up to the latter, I can tell. I can definitely tell. For those of you all who don't know, Mike Bonin actually has his own podcast, which I certainly am subscribed to, known as What's Next Los Angeles. And so this is a platform where you can continue to hear from Mike on various city issues, in conversation with various city leaders and reps. It's a great resource, and we'll definitely be getting into a little bit of the podcast's subjects today. But yeah, for those of you who don't know, Mike, you've been hosting this podcast for how long now?
I started it in 2020, I think, when I was cooped up in the house and did it intermittently. And then I've really stepped up doing it on a more regular basis once I was out of office.
Yeah, I mean, and there have been so many podcasts over the last handful of years. But just like you said, the pandemic saw, I think, an uptick. And you and I were talking about this before we started the show. There have also been podcasts going away and kind of like transitioning and such. So it's good to know that yours is still doing the thing and that actually you're seeking to do more of it in the days ahead.
Well, you know, there's this interesting developing ecosystem in LA for news and commentary, right? You've got LA Public Press is out there, Knock is out there, Capital in Maine is out there. You've got your podcast, my podcast, PCC has launched a podcast,
right?
LA Public Press has podcasts. There's this whole ecosystem out there of information, and I think we just sort of need to magnify each other's voices so that people can hear more about what's happening in LA.
Absolutely. I mean, it was definitely through tuning into your podcast that I learned a little bit, especially most recently, about news on the West Side. And I think having links between these various geographies in LA is also a part of that mission that you're talking about, right? Like, we need to remain in conversation because this city is connected from one end to the other, certainly in terms of policy. We're going to talk a little bit about that
for sure.
Today. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And, you know, I've been covering a lot of a West Side issue that we'll talk about today, the Barrington Plaza tenants. But I really want to start focusing on the rest of not just the city, but the county.
Yeah.
Really exciting stuff happening in like Linwood and,
right,
and Maywood and Cudahy
Southeast
and
side.
Stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's some fascinating stuff out there.
Yeah, of course. And it also brings into mind just how much this city spans, right? I mean, there are so many different places you can go to. But if we are, say, on the left and of the progressive state of mind, then as you said, there are a lot of exciting moments and movements all across LA, including on the southeast side, with respect to tenants' rights, yeah, with respect to progressive city policymaking, rent control,
labor,
being a part of that, labor as well. And what a moment in LA. I mean, I didn't, as you and I spoke the first time, I didn't think that when we'd be in convo again, there'd be all these other factors, but we have the actors' strike, yep, we have the writers' strike, we've got a number of these hotel workers out in Santa Monica. And so there's just a lot for labor out there, which I know you're a big fan of.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and one of the things that's sort of interesting right now is, you know, after anytime something negative happens, Trump takes office, Prop 8 passed, there's big demonstrations. And the question always becomes, can you take the energy of this moment, any of the two things I named or the BLM demonstrations, can you take that and organize it into something? And it's the same question now. You've got all of these people from different faces and branches of the labor movement out there together. You know, I was at a Unite Here rally, and the WGA was there, and SEIU was there. Can we keep that knitted together? When people in Pasadena and Cudahy and Culver City, LA County are all moving in the same direction on renter stuff, how can we knit that into something? I think there's, and those two issues I think are really key, because I think there's a real exciting potential for sort of an ascendant progressive movement that is really anchored in both labor and tenant issues.
That's right. That's right. I mean, and I'm not sure if you've read Mike Davis and John Wiener's Set the Night on Fire, but that's a great history of organizing in Los Angeles, including in these various geographies, these various parts of the city, the South Side, the West Side, LA County a little bit.
I'm glad you mentioned it. I actually just got it. It's on my stack of books that I need to start cracking open, and so that'll be next.
Yeah, I think you're really going to like that, and I look forward to your thoughts on that, and maybe we can even put together a book club at some point, because that's something I'm also a huge fan of as I think about conversations with other tenants, other renters, other people out in the city who are looking at the desperation ramping up. That's the other side of, yeah, this coin is, especially I think after people went to the polls this past November, voted some of the right people into office, though not all and not in every case, they are now looking at the city again and wondering, wait, what's with everything ramping up? What's with all these new tents on the street? What is with more crime on Metro's lines and so on? What's going on? And I think it sort of gets into this tricky space where you let people know once again as like not a representative of the state, but certainly someone who's consistently in conversation with the state, that like there are certainly people working on the ground to get folks off the street into shelter, to get folks connected to the right resources, to stop calling the wrong resources, yep, on those in need and so on and so forth. It's just that, once again, we are in such a massive, sprawling city. It's hard to look at it all at once. And sometimes what is focused on, what is really highlighted, is what's not working. That's what gets all the buzz. And then that's what becomes the general sense of where we are.
That's true. The other thing that's not focused on enough are the real things that cause homelessness. Right? We focus a lot on tents and encampments.
That's right.
The mayor's approach, and often mine when I was in office, city policy gets driven around the question of encampments. But the things we don't talk about enough are the way that, you know, American capitalism manufactures homelessness. We have, you know, income inequality. We have out of control housing prices, even rental prices. We've got, you know, a still failing healthcare system, particularly a mental health care system. We don't provide for people to sort of transition back into society when they get out of jails or prisons. We create homelessness, and we're creating it more rapidly than we used to. So for, you know, every person that the city houses, someone else plus is becoming homeless. And the city could house more people than it ever has, and it has. But homelessness can still get worse if we don't address those real systemic causes. And, I mean, there are people who, it's harder to address systemic causes because it's more complex, right?
That's right.
It's harder for journalism to cover. It's hard to do that on television, right?
Sure.
That doesn't lend itself to the 6 o'clock news. But there are also really powerful entrenched interests that are fighting changes in that. And a key one right now, corporate landlords.
That's right.
You know, voters approved Measure ULA to help address homelessness, support renters last November by an enormous margin. And the wealthy real estate interests, the corporate landlords, spent a ton against it. Now they're suing to stop it, while in a couple places they're evicting people en masse. And that's what they do. They don't want to change.
I also think it's really powerful the way that you are somewhat reframing the narrative here on homelessness. When you say we are creating homelessness, that is taking into account this very important part of the onus, right? You are saying the city, but also this economic system and a lack of care built into the current models that we have for folks, that is playing a huge role in why people have nowhere to go. I mean, we just had this catastrophe, this disaster in Hawaii,
yep.
And you have tens of thousands of people who will be without shelter within the next handful of years. And that has ripple effects over the long term, not just economically, but maybe just as importantly, socially. The natural disasters that people have to deal with on a day-to-day basis, which are often unseen when we're talking about working-class people,
yep.
Those things have devastating long-term impacts on their ability to sustain themselves in a system that's designed for them to lose their job eventually, for them to lose their housing eventually, for them to end up on the street eventually, not just in Los Angeles, but across the United States. I think I saw just online the other day that recently, at least 30 economists came out and noted that you can find no place in the United States where a minimum wage worker can afford a two-bedroom apartment.
Nope.
No place in all of the U.S.
Certainly not California.
Definitely not here. And so I am very mindful of renters and their struggle increasingly getting attention at long last in what feels like an overdue spotlight for where they are and what we're missing, what policymaking is missing when it comes to getting people shelter, very basic, decent rights, if you will.
Very basic, decent rights. And you know, in Hawaii, you mentioned Maui, as soon as the fires ended, real estate speculators were going in and trying to buy up people's properties where the homes burned down.
Incredible.
The governor of Hawaii has proposed a bill saying you can't do real estate sales right now because it's just going to be speculation, which will wind up gentrifying and displacing people permanently, increasing homelessness, creating sort of a second wave of the disaster. And in terms of renters' voices are magnifying. Finally, it's a good thing. I mean, they're sort of political and economic apartheid in this country, where rich people have an outsized influence, an outsized vote, an outsized voice.
That's right.
And in L.A., it's always been balanced towards homeowners. That's finally starting to shift in terms, partially because we shifted the election cycle to even-numbered years, and that has a different electorate. And, you know, we're getting some people who are renters and who really care about renters' issues on the council and in smaller cities as well.
That's right. And even on the state assembly, there's a growing awareness that renters have not been represented, have not been at the state's capital. And so we're finally starting to bring some visibility into that. But of course, there's a long way to go. And sometimes you come across news that just stuns you, including what you were saying about speculation moving at a knee-jerk reaction to go ahead and gentrify Maui after this devastating fire, this devastating and capitalist-driven catastrophe that we'll call natural, but that was certainly also the result of at least a century of robbing this place of its natural resources, that is. And what I mean by this, of course, is a big news item that you were talking about very recently on your podcast concerning the Barrington Plaza.
Yeah.
And what looks to be, if we're correct here, the largest mass eviction in LA history, period, in LA history ever.
Maybe the largest since Chavez Ravine when Dodger Stadium was built. The second would be another West Side one, Lincoln Place in Venice, garden-style apartments. There was a huge eviction in 2005 or six. Barrington Plaza, for those who aren't familiar, is 712, I think, units, rent-control units on the west side of Los Angeles near Wilshire and the 405. It's three towers. Working-class folks, people who teach, people who are nurses, teacher's assistants, Lyft drivers, waiters, some people who've been there for 30, 40 years.
Right.
And the building has caught fire a couple times. There are 55 residential high-rises in Los Angeles that don't have fire sprinklers. They were sort of grandfathered in. This is one of them. Two fires in the past couple decades. Someone died in a fire in February of 2020,
right
before the pandemic. And I immediately proposed, we need to mandate sprinklers in all of these buildings. Landlords need to step up and they need to install these.
Oh, to be sure then, for the listener who may be meeting Mike for the first time, Mike was the city council representative for CD11, which includes that side of town, which he describes that houses these tenants. About 577 units are taken up currently, from what I understand. But just to be sure, Mike was the acting city council member for that neighborhood at that time in 2020.
Yes, 2013 to 2022. And I proposed back in 2020, we mandate these places get sprinklers. Everybody was behind that idea for like 36 hours. And then, you know, the pandemic hit and forces that don't want to do the work hit. And during the pandemic, the owner of the building, it's a multi-billion dollar real estate investment firm, Douglas Emmett Inc.
Right.
They came to me and said, hey, we'll do the sprinklers, but we need your help. We need you to change the RSO, which is the rent stabilization ordinance, the rent control ordinance. I had no idea what the significance of what they were proposing was, so I brought in Larry Gross from Coalition for Economic Survival. Larry said this would be a disaster. It would be the largest mass eviction since Chavez Ravine. Because what they were proposing, the city's rent control rules say if you're going to do sort of rehabs, renovations, you can move people out temporarily, but you have to put them somewhere else and then allow them to move back in. They wanted to be exempt from that. I said no. So they spent, you know, a fortune, hundreds of thousands of dollars on the person who was elected to succeed me, Tracy Park, against Aaron Darling, who was a tenant rights attorney. Spent a lot of money on city attorney Heidi Feldstein Soto. And as soon as the pandemic era eviction stuff was lifted, they gave notices they're evicting everybody. And they did it. They couldn't under the city's rent control rules. So they're using, this is wonky, but it's important, a state law called the Ellis Act.
That's right.
And it says owners can get out of the rental business. Now, it was written like in the 90s. By State Senator David Roberti of Los Angeles, not by him, but he fought it. And the intention of it, as he will tell you, was to allow mom-and-pop landlords to go to business.
Right.
Not these billion-dollar corporations. And so they said they're going to go out of the rental business, but they're not going out of the rental business. They're a rental company.
Right.
And they have even said for this building, they don't know what they're going to do.
That's what strikes me so much about this, Mike, is that they somehow have successfully gotten through this narrative that they don't know what the future holds. And somehow that has stood up in court.
Yep.
Because just this past week, just a few days ago, there was a preliminary injunction that was dismissed by a judge overhearing this case that, of course, the Tenants Association at Barrington Plaza was proposing. And so somehow what really strikes me here is that this not mom and pop business, because this is what is continually cited, especially by apartment associations when it comes to the Ellis Act. They continually cite that this law was originally passed to support mom and pop landlords. Yep. Douglas Emmett, as you said, is a $2.1 billion company, if that's what we call mom and pop in California, we have to start redefining a whole lot of different things.
Yeah.
But what strikes me is that they can say, we don't know what's going to happen, but we can kick these people out to do these renovations anyway. From what I understand, the law stipulates that they can, as you were saying, temporarily relocate people if they have to do renovations. But what they're saying is, we don't know how long the renovations might take.
Yeah.
And so that's that. We just need to get this done and get these people out of here. I don't understand how that's allowed to move forward.
Well, it's lies, fraud, and malfeasance, all coated with a big layer of greed. So, first of all, the reason they're doing this is if they do it according to the city's rent control rules, everybody gets to come back, and they're still under rent control, right? They do it their way. They can evict everybody. Once they rehab, they can get new tenants at current market rate, right? So they make a ton more money. That's why they're doing it. Now, they're pretty clearly lying about what's going on there. The tenants and I have heard from sprinkler fitters, the Sprinkler Fitters Association, the local union that has looked at the building, looked at other buildings, and they said that the cost and the time and the work that Douglas Emmett is throwing out there is not true. They said that you don't need to move everybody out of the building. You can do it in phases. And Douglas Emmett's saying this will cost him $300 million in 5 years. These guys are saying, you know, there are equivalent buildings where it's been done for $5, $10 million, and it can be done much more quickly. So they're lying on that. And then, you know, the malfeasance is the city attorney. The city attorney and the housing department are saying, oh, there's nothing the city can do about this. If they say they're going out of the rental business, that's how it is. But they're refusing to look at the city's laws, the rent control ordinance, which says this has to be done in good faith. It's clearly not being done in good faith. And the city should be investigating, and the city should have been in court with these tenants fighting for them.
I think you're absolutely right that an investigation at the very least is what needs to take place here. Because if we're saying I need to install sprinklers through this set of buildings, I don't know how long that can take. Well, then, as you said, how about we speak to some people who work in this field and ask them, since they're the professionals, since you're going to have to hire people just like them anyway, what the timeline could be. So I think it's such a huge moment for Los Angeles for us to place into perspective, because what we're effectively saying, should these evictions go through, is that landlords can and will have their way in the second largest city in America, which is full of renters. If Douglas Emmett is allowed to do this, it sets a precedent to completely reinterpret the Ellis Act in a number of cases, not just here on the West Side.
A huge precedent, right? I mean, the 500 and something tenants here, 500 and something households here, they're never going to find housing on the West Side again. Right? It's just not possible. Their lives disrupted. That's just the immediate impact.
That's right.
The dominoes that fall from this, you can't even calculate. There are 55 residential high-rises that need to have sprinklers. Some of them are condos. A lot of them are rentals. Certainly thousands of units of rental units around the city, including Park La Brea is a big one.
Right.
Lots of big ones, big tower buildings, a lot of them in Katie Yaroslavsky's district.
Wow.
And that's thousands of units. If Douglas Emmett gets away with it, you know these other corporate landlords are going to do the same thing.
Right.
And then, as Chelsea Kirk from Sage wrote in an op-ed in the LA Times a couple months ago, as we start retrofitting buildings to deal with the climate crisis, with more air conditioning or more electric as opposed to gas, landlords will be able to use that precedent as well. And we spoke a few minutes ago about the systemic hidden causes of homelessness. There's no way the city can make any progress in its goal against homelessness if we have thousands of people losing their homes from the remaining affordable rental stock in Los Angeles.
Yeah, it's the right hand getting in front of the left. and no less. What we're also talking about here, just to be sure, given that these folks are on the West Side, are not necessarily what one may think of, are not necessarily the kind of folks that we might think of when it comes to the West Side, because we're talking about senior citizens. Yep. I read an op-ed on the LA Times written by a 71-year-old man who lives at this building, who is to some extent preparing to quite possibly be homeless within the next couple of years because there is nowhere else he can go. From what I understand, Barrington Plaza is also probably the third largest RSO protected building in the city of LA. Yep. So if you take that out, by every means, you are creating a domino effect that is just completely antithetical to, quote, solving homelessness, unquote, in Los Angeles. So it becomes an all-encompassing issue. It's very much a question of who we are and what our value system is. And so I'm really taken up by this case. I'm moved by it.
Well, and it touches on a lot of other stuff, right? Because Douglas Emmett, like a lot of other corporate landlords, spent a lot on the last election, right? A lot of the candidates they backed lost. They were, you know, they were behind Gil Cedillo, they were behind Mitch O'Farrell. But they got in Councilwoman Park, who succeeded me, and they got in Heidi Feldstein Soto. They also spent a ton of money trying to defeat ULA, which helps with affordable housing, helps renters, helps combat homelessness. Now they're suing to stop it from being implemented. Beyond that, there was news this morning, the California Business Roundtable, to which Douglas Emmett and other corporate landlords in Los Angeles are big contributors, are trying to get a case to go to the U.S. Supreme Court to repeal rent control nationwide. I mean, this is just... These are bad, bad actors, and it needs to be exposed. And you know, there's two sort of poles in Los Angeles right now on the rental issue. The tent pole on the west side is Barrington Plaza, and then you've got Hillside Villa on the other side of town. And that's been in the news longer.
That's right.
And is a very different fight, but both of them sort of a sign of the battles to come if we don't get ahead of them.
Yeah, I really appreciate you saying this because it also brings into perspective just how layered so much of the fight for housing tends to be. I mean, it spans beyond just the people that you may see in the immediate vicinity. It literally encompasses every last one of us in this town because we're all dealing with housing challenges, with housing issues, with a limited housing stock, and with these actors who are busy at work doing their best to undo every last protection in this city and throughout this state. And LA and California are also renowned for rent control because yep. Rent control is not, it's not applied all across the United States, generally speaking. Yep. LA is actually at the forefront. It's one of the pioneering cities for tenant protections along with San Francisco, and that is California overall. And so it tells you a little bit about exactly how busy these folks are trying to reap as many profits as they can, even if it means destroying cities and neighborhoods yep. and whole communities, as is the case at Barrington Plaza and as is the case over at the Hillside Villa just as well.
And this sort of battle over housing, as you said, touches everything. It is fundamental to sort of both sides of the fight over the strikes right now. Right? The hotel workers unite here. They're out there, and one of their core arguments is their employees, their members, need to be paid well enough to live near where they work because they can't afford to live in Los Angeles. LA Times profiled a hotel worker a month ago or so who, on the four nights they worked, slept in their car because they couldn't make the commute right. every day and they couldn't afford to live close by. In the entertainment industry, we've had entertainment industry execs quoted in the Hollywood Reporter anonymously saying, oh, we're going to let this go on for a few months until they start losing right. their homes and their apartments. It's fundamental to everything going on.
Right, and it's fascinating because if you read a little bit about the history of some of the planning behind housing over the course of decades and even centuries, it wasn't always this way. There used to be systems in which, especially these landowners, they made sure that their workers were housed because they needed their workers on the land yeah. to do the work. And somehow we've gotten to this point where workers are expected to just pay more in every last respect, in terms of time, in terms of the energy and bandwidth it takes to go to make the commute from one side of town to the other. And it is just at a breaking point. And so to some extent, of course, when you are connected with these communities and you see the various voices who are truly at the forefront organizing and making certain that people know how to defend themselves, yes, there is much to be anxious for, but there's also a lot to be excited about, because the people are connecting these dots in such a critical way at an inflection point here.
Yep, absolutely.
Hey, Los Angeles, I hope you're enjoying this conversation as much as I am. I just want to take a moment to invite you to my Patreon channel, which supports JT the LA Storyteller podcast in more ways than one, and which also provides just a little more from each convo. And of course, this is because it takes a little bit of work to put this podcast together, including research and reaching out to folks and scheduling things. And then studio time, editing time, finally publishing, and then a little bit of marketing time. And the Patreon channel is just the best way to support all of that, to support independent storytelling in LA by JT the LA Storyteller. So I would love your support, and I can give you my word that it's going to be more than worth it. Now, back to the show.
Absolutely.
Now, with respect to this, we mentioned Hillside Villa on the other side of LA, where you've had this association of tenants at Hillside organizing to stop their own eviction, because here in Chinatown, you've got an affordable housing covenant or deed that has expired, that expired very recently.
A lot of that going around.
And yes, that's something I want to get into with you in just a moment. This whole process of calling affordable housing, and then not quite knowing the overall definition, because at the end of the day, if what we have at Hillside Villa is a covenant that ultimately expires, that one day just is no longer applicable, and that a landlord can then start to boost rents after, then we have an issue. We have a real issue on our hands, because there's a whole lot of affordable housing out there on a timeline that, once through, gives landlords the right to say rent's going up by 200%. If you can't afford it, see ya.
Yep.
That's exactly what's going on at Hillside right now.
That's exactly what's going on. And it's happening in a lot of different places. I think Hillside has been the most vocal and the most organized in resisting it. There are a lot of buildings in Los Angeles that had a 35 or a 55 year affordability covenant. Now, when you're an elected official and you're getting a project approved, 55 is, you know, by the time it expires, you're probably going to be dead, right? So it's past your horizon of caring. But we're now at a point where that horizon has passed in a lot of places, and Los Angeles is losing a lot of affordable housing stock as a result of those covenants expiring. And there's some sort of short-term fixes, and then there's some long-term fixes, right? Short-term fixes is, you know, one thing we could do with the ULA money, if they stop suing and we can spend it, is we could buy out or extend those covenants, right? We could say to a landlord, hey, we want to buy this out for another 30 years. Again, that's a Band-Aid. It's a 30-year Band-Aid. What we really need to be doing is we need social housing in Los Angeles.
Right.
And I'll explain what it is in a second. When I first proposed it, and I think it was January or February of 2020, people didn't know what the hell I was talking about, except for the 50 activists who were standing around me on the steps of City Hall. Now, with new members of the council, with Nitya there, with Ugo there, with Eunice there, Marquise is pushing on it, we're getting some momentum behind this idea, which is, it's a different type of public housing. Right? Public housing in the United States is, the government neglects it.
Right.
It's not a great accommodation. It doesn't treat people well. It tends to be sort of, you know, segregated poverty. In other places, in Hong Kong, in Europe, they have social housing, which is mixed income, permanently affordable. You pay what you can, and in these places, you have people who are struggling who can't really afford much at all. You also have people who, you might even have government officials or celebrities working there. It's a real community. It's near transit. It's near parks. It's near hospitals. It's public housing done right. And the market, we keep looking at market solutions to address a housing affordability crisis. And so if you're going to build a 100% affordable housing project in Los Angeles, the city ain't going to own it right now, right? It's going to be some nonprofit developer is going to get the land, maybe even from the city, and then it's going to take them years and like advanced calculus to come up with a tax incentive here, a tax credit here, to pull the money together. It's a ridiculous way of doing things that can't meet the moment. And so getting real social housing is something we need to do.
Right, and it's also interest-based, that model where a nonprofit somewhere is going to go and find land and then even find developers for it. We learned through some of our research out here on the Central Side that these nonprofits got to take loans too.
Yeah.
Those loans have interest on them. If they don't build within a certain time span, the interest just goes up. They have more to pay back. And as you said, if it's going to be social, if it's going to be extremely low income, then there have to be some other kind of commercial tenants that can really make a sustainable model there. And so it's a tough way out. But I think that what we're also saying here is that we have landlords and developers entirely invested in destroying even the possibility of care-based systems.
Yes.
Because that's all that Measure ULA at the end of the day is trying to achieve. And then, of course, on the other hand, when you have tenants associations who are saying or asking for prelim injunctions and who are also saying that they have nowhere else to go if this is inflicted upon them, that is far less funded. That is far less popular. There are certainly those of us rooting for these communities, but we don't have the billions of dollars behind us, as does Douglas Emmett. So it's a serious dichotomy. It's a serious polar opposite, just as you were saying. And what's also true is some folks have pointed out that Hillside Villa is supposed to be taken up by the city soon through eminent domain.
Yeah.
But even way back when I was speaking with Onesis on this podcast, Onesis said eminent domain takes a while. Like,
it does.
It's not the only model that we can nor should apply to our housing crisis.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a common denominator between the two very different situations of Barrington Plaza and Hillside Villa. In Barrington, they had a defeat in court this week, but it was only a partial defeat. There's still an opportunity for them to battle Douglas Emmett. The unlawful detainer cases, the actual eviction cases, the court said you can hear them all as one case.
Right.
So there'll be a lot more emphasis on it. It's not one person going up against Douglas Emmett. It's the whole collection of them going up against Douglas Emmett. If people donate to that and support that, that helps them a lot. But imagine if the city affirmatively took action and said, as the city has the authority to do, this is fraudulent behavior. We're suing on behalf of the tenants. That would be huge. Our city attorney, who is a landlord, who has the support of the realtors, doesn't want to do that. Hillside Villa, Aenisius is right. Doing eminent domain takes a long time. But this has been in the hopper for a long time.
That's right.
Part of the issue, the Hillside Villa tenants will tell you, is the city attorney is dragging her feet on this. Mm. And, you know, that was the subject of my podcast this week, is the trouble with Heidi.
Right.
She is also standing in the way of new affordable and homeless housing, at least on the west side. I don't know what she's doing in the rest of the city, but it's a consistent problem. And we can't afford to get tripped up on homelessness, on affordable housing, on renter protections. The stakes are too high and things are moving too fast.
That's right. And I think for voters generally speaking out there who are wondering about what they can do, we're talking business owners, we're talking people that are having to look after their families, folks who have health challenges, medical bills, as you said. The news cycle comes along every now and again, talks about a vote. A council member that maybe they have a say on is up for election or re-election in some cases. But the city attorney's office is one that's easy to miss. And I think that's something that has taken place continually. in our election cycles here. And I think what you're doing through your discussion is casting a light on the importance of this position to enforce basic rights, including civil rights, that people should have respected in the city of Los Angeles. I think that's something to hone in on for a moment.
For sure, for sure. And more people, the mayor included, need to be speaking up and offering the counter opinion to the city attorney. You know, as I said the other day, you know, the mayor's approach has been to lock arms, which is great because she's moved forward
right.
in a huge amount of a short amount of time. She's moved a huge amount of territory forward. But in this case, locking arms with the city attorney is dragging you back.
Right.
And we can't afford to not help tenants. We can't afford to slow down affordable housing.
Right. I mean, in these cases, the city going to court and going to bat for the people who make up its tax base, for the people it is designed to serve, that is absolutely critical. So I do encourage listeners to go and check out Mike's podcast on Heidi Soto. It is a key discussion with other community members as to what the city attorney's office can and should be doing in the interest of those who make up this city. Mike, I also want to talk to you a little bit about affordable housing because we mentioned this covenant expiring. We mentioned the fact that it's on a timer. It's also important to note that the situation at Hillside Villa is playing out across all of Los Angeles.
Yes.
And so you have a lot of affordable housing that we stand to lose once these covenants expire. So this is something that listeners should also be paying close attention to in order to keep people housed, just very basically, right? Because as you were noting earlier, it's not just about those who you see at the last frontier out on the corner underneath an encampment. It's also these people who are living paycheck to paycheck and in some cases who have no idea that next year, this place they have yep. spent their lives at can no longer qualify as affordable.
Absolutely. That happens so often. I've seen it happening on the west side during the time I was in office. It's a lot of those 55-year covenants are hitting right now. And if the city is going to be making any significant progress on homelessness, we have to be creating more inventory of affordable housing. And we can't lose what we already have. We have to preserve and protect it. And that's not as sexy because there's not usually a ribbon cutting
right.
and all that kind of stuff. And I know that the mayor and most of the council cares about that. Getting a strategy in place to do it is hard. The city is in some ways limited by state law. The city is in some ways limited by money. That gets easier if the corporate landlords and real estate stop interfering with ULA. And it gets interfered with by the city attorney who says anytime that the city tries to do something outside of the box, too risky, going to expose us to too much money. The city has a history of saying, if you're going to take a chance on helping people, it's too risky.
Right.
You do something really big. When we tried to do a more robust eviction moratorium in 2020,
right.
too risky, you might get sued. But the city has had no problem taking big risks to criminalize homelessness and has
right.
lost every case
right,
for a generation.
Right, and actually, going back to rent control for a moment, from what I understand, from what I've seen, Oppenheimer has been making the rounds over the last couple of weeks because of the premiere. From what I understand, during World War II, rent control was enacted nationwide. So it was actually a situation of making certain that people were housed so that they could support this economy. So we have done that before. We've also seen over the course of the pandemic that you can do big things and really move forward in that direction from there on out. And so I think you are onto something here in that the city can, in fact, take a leap and work for the people that it's supposed to represent. I've seen the same thing in the planning process, that
yep.
is the city planning process, where a whole lot of these planning commissions, they tend to stay away from any major changes. They tend to just mimic what their predecessors have gone
yeah.
for because that seems to be the safest route. But actually, you're on a moving train. You cannot be neutral on a moving train is what Howard Zinn once said. And we're exactly that here in Los Angeles. our city officials have to step up and set precedents and be pioneers for our communities.
And, you know, I think the way history is going to judge this decade or two is going to look at it in terms of this was a time where the challenges were huge and the opportunities to address them were huge. And it's going to ask the question, did the people in charge seize those opportunities? You know, I thought nationally, COVID presented the opportunity for, you know, a 21st century New Deal, Green New Deal or New Deal. It was an opportunity to really provide for people in a long-term way instead of just sort of an emergency way. And that didn't happen. There was too much bullshit in Washington, too much Trump energy, too much of the MAGA that interfered with that. At the city, some big things happened. You know, ULA came out of that. You know, there's a lot of stuff that Nithya and Ugo and Aunisi's got through, the Just Cause Eviction Protection, which is huge
right.
in Los Angeles.
Right.
Huge leap forward. But there's still so many things that we haven't done. And, I mean, housing is one area. You know, the climate crisis is another where we're just not swinging for the fences.
That's right. That's right. And in terms of, once again, big city planning and stats or data with respect to this in our towns, in our neighborhoods, I've also seen that zoning and zoning restrictions tend to play a huge role in what gets built where. And so given that a lot of, not just Los Angeles, but a lot of the United States' residential land is zoned just for single family housing, that's played a huge role in basically barring people from entering many parts of the city. And so it continues to stifle us, even though we have had SB 9 and SB 10 allow for certain exceptions. The fact of the matter is that zoning continues to segregate the city in more ways than not.
It absolutely does. I mean, the district I represented on the west side is a prime example of that. You know, there are not only is so much of it single family, there are parts of it that are multifamily that have single family on them, right? So Venice has lost population over the past 15 years because people bought a multifamily plot with like a fourplex,
right?
Turned into a mega mansion,
right?
Right. So we've even as bad as it is on paper, it's actually worse in reality. One of the, I don't regret a lot about not running for a third term, but one thing I do regret is I wish I had done more on housing density when I was in office, and I wish I had been there for a third term to see through to the completion the community plan updates happening on the west side right now, because two-thirds of the district I used to represent, West L.A., Mar Vista, Del Rey, Venice, Mar Vista, Del Rey, Playa Vista, Westchester, all of them are undergoing a community plan update, mm-hmm. and my goal was we got to densify.
Of course.
West Side needs to
really build
up.
That's right.
I fought that fight mainly over homeless housing, which took up every ounce of energy. But that needs to happen right now.
That's right. That's right. The planning commissions are a big deal, and they can be very, very frustrating meetings to have to sit through as well for those of us who seek to have Los Angeles build up and have these neighborhoods basically take their fair share of the burden. Because up to this point, a lot of the building is taking place on this side of town where people have historically been segregated, where people have historically had small access or very limited voices to city planning and city governance. And so I'm certainly rooting for advocates out on the west side and throughout the city to persuade these interests, these power brokers, that Los Angeles is at an inflection point. And that it's now or it's just not going to happen.
And if we don't do it locally, the state is going to make it happen anyway.
Right.
So, you know, I look back, I was just doing an interview with some UCLA grad students who were doing an urban planning thing. They were looking at a project that got approved that I opposed back in like 2016 or 17. And it's near my house. It's in Mar Vista. And I think they were surprised to hear me say, yeah, I got that wrong. I should have supported. It's like five or six stories. It's on Venice Boulevard.
Right.
Six stories is not a problem there. It's got, you know, a small affordable component. Would have been nice if it had more. It's got mixed use on the ground floor, hasn't right. opened yet. But it was a perfectly sensible project, and we need more of them. And I think I was fighting a lot of homeless battles, so I only had so much energy to spend.
Right.
But I think I underestimated the people I represented in their willingness to accept more housing. And I think most people are fine with it now. I think more people would be fine with it if we did more. The thing I think that needs to be worked out, though, is if I look at Venice Boulevard and Mar Vista, most everything is one or two stories.
Yeah.
And it could easily be five or six stories, not a problem.
Yeah.
A lot of the people, though, who are living in the little bungalows or the one or two story apartments are the same people we've been talking about who live at Barrington Plaza and Hillside Villa.
Right.
And what happens to them? How do we prevent them, when we add more density, from being displaced out of the West Side entirely?
That's right. I mean, and that's going on right here in Central LA as well, right here in City 13 just as well. That is in Councilmember Hugo Soto Martinez's office, where you have what is new housing coming in, often with about maybe 10% set aside for low-income units. But the question is, how does that come up without all this disruption for those who remain, for those who must be moved out, for those who must be relocated, and so on and so forth? It's a huge question, and it speaks to just how many different challenges LA and the state of California are facing on the housing front, because we've talked today about the final frontier, that is homelessness right on the sidewalk. We've talked about the expiration of affordability for tens of thousands of units, untold numbers, though there are researchers working on outlining exactly where you can find more of these affordable housing covenants. I think even City Controller Kenneth Mejia's office has put together a GIS map out there for it. We've also talked about the way that these billion-dollar companies are suing and using litigation to stop any social or care-based systems for housing in Los Angeles. And so we are here talking about multiple fronts for this challenge. It's going to take some time.
It is. It's going to take some time. I'm encouraged by what I'm seeing in Sacramento. You know, the fact that Matt Haney and Isaac Bryan and Alex Lee formed that renters caucus, I think, is a big step up there.
I
think Sacramento is going to be moving on housing stuff, and hopefully Los Angeles will be one of the cities that embraces it, as opposed to, you know, some of the Orange County cities or Beverly Hills that try to sue to stop it.
Looking at you, Huntington Beach, looking at you. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it's just like you said as well, there was a convo, and you can hear some of it on Mike Bonin's last podcast episode alongside Godfrey Santos Plata, as well as Marissa Roy, I believe
it is. Marissa Roy.
You can hear a little bit of the talk of redistricting. A lot of people out here, including our elected officials, have scoffed at the idea that, say, Sacramento would outline what redistricting in the city of LA would look like. But get this, if we don't get housing and our policy on housing and our policy at these planning commissions correctly, then the state has no choice but to come bashing down the door, because it's a crisis that is leading to an exodus that is leading the state of California to lose influence, to lose workers to other states. And so it's about time for us to really right this ship.
Yep, it is. And I should be forthcoming on this. You know, when I was on the council, I did what most council members did, and I was opposed to the state doing what they were doing. Right? We always weighed in against the state legislation. And we created the dynamic where they had to act, and we didn't act enough locally. And so that thing's going to keep on coming. And
yeah, it's very ironic, because I also heard the discussion with Yaroslavsky, and I like what he said about this visit from the Crown at some point to the city of LA, where it was one of the dukes or so who pointed out that LA and its city and its city governance and county governance are all designed not to govern. And
this is a great story. This is an interview I did with Zev Yaroslavsky, who 40 years in office, county supervisor, city councilman, represented parts of the
Tough
West Side.
Mutter.
He just wrote his memoir, Zev's Los Angeles. Great read. I recommend it. And in it, he tells the story about at one point when he was on the city council, Prince Philip, who was Duke of Edinburgh, who was the husband of Queen Elizabeth, came to Los Angeles. And I guess Zev was a supervisor. And he said, so what does a supervisor do?
Oh, right.
And Zev explained it. And he said, so now I understand it. This is designed not to work.
Yeah.
And that's true.
Right. It is true. And Zev actually, I picked up that memoir thanks to your podcast, and I'm hanging on to it because I rented it at the LA Library. Don't place it on hold, Los Angeles, because I need it for at least the next 6 weeks, please. But that said, yeah, he brings up a whole different angle, which is that, yes, like, government is sluggish. Government is one of these systems that is going to take time. But especially in Zev's eyes, given what his family has seen, things need to have a process to them, and things need to be somewhat lethargic in order to make sure that we strike a balance here.
Well, yeah,
I think where he's coming from.
Well, and city government and county government in Los Angeles is designed that way for a reason. Right? It was designed as part of progressive reforms 100 years ago. Because of corruption, people didn't want power concentrated in too few hands.
Right.
They wanted it spread out, which is why there's so many commissions, so many different layers of government. That was by design, and it was to prevent corruption and make government closer to the people. I think the pendulum has now swung in the other direction, and now government can't move fast enough to deal with crises. And nobody's really responsible enough with diffused power to be held accountable.
That's right. That's right. And so once again, going back to the listeners, going back to the convos that we have day in and day out, people out there see this and think, well, it's just not working then. You know, whether it's Bass or whether it's Caruso, it's all the same system. A lot of people get that sort of idea going. But I think what's also true here, what we've discussed here, is that it takes folks getting out there. It takes folks making their voices heard. It takes folks calling a foul play, as is the case over at Barrington Plaza, to get these systems to do what they were ultimately designed to do if they were built in good faith. So being active and getting your voice out there is an instrumental part of the process. The system does not work if not for our participation in a very substantial way. And I think I've really gotten that in our discussion today.
Well, thank you. You know, a lot of people, some in a fond way and some in a negative way, have asked me why I'm continuing to stay engaged in stuff. People who like me and welcome my participation say it, oh, this is great. And then, you know, sort of the Twitter trolls are like, why the fuck are you still, you know, go away, you know? Aren't you supposed to be dealing with your mental health? Go away. And why would I go away? Right? I ran for office because I love the city of Los Angeles and I care. And so I'm not in office. I said when I said I wasn't running, I was going to leave City Hall but not leave the fight. And
that's right. That's right.
There's a lot of stuff that needs to be worked on in Los Angeles. And, you know, I can be a soldier in that battle now.
That's right.
And I've got a bit of a megaphone to use. So I'm going to continue to use it because we got to get stuff done.
That's right. So shout out once again to all those making sure that this dialogue is heard, that our people and our communities are seen. Mike here is over at What's Next Los Angeles. Mike also has a newsletter that you can sign up for. We'll link these in the show notes. I really appreciate your time here. I really appreciate that you're still making your voice heard, because it's going to take every last one of us on this moving train.
Yes, it is. Thanks for having me, man. Really appreciate it.
It's Jimbo times.